Detective Sam Porter's day begins with a text from his partner, "Call me 911." At the scene, what appears to be a suicide by bus turns into something far more sinister when Porter discovers a small white box tied with black string, the signature of Chicago's notorious Four Monkey Killer. Inside lies a severed ear, confirming his worst fears. But here's the twist. The dead man appears to be the killer himself, carrying a diary that begins with a chilling confession. "I'm a murderer. I have a genius IQ of 156. I kill for various reasons: necessity, hate, pleasure." The discovery sends Porter racing to protect potential victims, particularly 15-year-old Emery Connors, the secret daughter of wealthy businessman Arthur Talbot. What makes this thriller immediately gripping isn't just the gruesome details, it's how it subverts expectations. Most serial killer stories begin with the hunt for an unknown predator, but here, the killer is seemingly dead from page one. The mystery isn't who he is, but why he chose to die now and what his final act of vengeance will be. The ticking clock to find Emery alive creates an urgency that pulls you deeper into the darkness. Psychological case studies reveal how childhood experiences can shape destructive behaviors. In this instance, court documents describe a subject's upbringing that presented an idealized facade: a prosperous family with traditional values and weekend family outings, while concealing serious dysfunction beneath the surface. The subject's early psychological development was marked by inappropriate exposure to adult situations and boundary violations. His parents modeled destructive relationship patterns and involved him in witnessing increasingly concerning behaviors. A pivotal incident occurred when his parents committed a serious crime against a neighbor who had confronted them about their conduct, forcing the child to observe acts of extreme violence. Most notable from a clinical perspective is the emotional dissociation evident in the subject's written accounts. He describes traumatic events with the same detached tone used for ordinary daily activities, a common defense mechanism seen in cases of childhood trauma. This case raises important questions about how well we understand the people in our communities and the hidden psychological damage that can develop behind seemingly normal exteriors. The analysis demonstrates how early exposure to violence and boundary violations, particularly from primary caregivers, can contribute to severe psychological dysfunction in adulthood. This understanding is crucial for mental health professionals and law enforcement in prevention and early intervention efforts. 15-year-old Emery Connors awakens in darkness, disoriented and in agony. Her ear has been cut off, she's handcuffed to a hospital gurney, and she's naked and terrified. She recalls being abducted by a man pretending to have lost his dog, who injected her with something that overcame her self-defense training. Emery surveys her prison, a square cinder block room with no visible door. Suddenly, deafening music blasts, Mick Jagger singing about the devil, causing her to hit her wounded ear. Days pass as her condition deteriorates. Severely dehydrated with an infected wrist, she hallucinates conversations with her dead mother. When rats scurry around her in darkness, she imagines them forming a pyramid to reach her. The psychological torture alternates between sensory deprivation and overwhelming assault, complete darkness broken by blinding light, silence shattered by deafening music. This isn't the darkness of a bedroom, but the absolute absence of light where the mind creates horrors to fill the void. The killer's twisted moral code stems from the Three Wise Monkeys philosophy: see no evil, Mizaru; hear no evil, Kikizaru; and speak no evil, Iwazaru; plus the lesser-known fourth monkey, Shizaru, who represents do no evil. This framework guides his methodology as he removes victims' eyes, ears, and tongues before killing them. His diary reveals this philosophy was instilled by his father. When Mrs. Carter was held captive in their basement, his father explained they killed Mr. Carter for breaking the fourth rule by threatening the boy's mother. This warped sense of justice became the foundation for the Four Monkey Killers' crimes. What's disturbing is how this framework perverts a traditional moral teaching. The killer believes he's delivering justice, not committing crimes, seeing himself as necessary correction to a corrupt world. It demonstrates how easily moral principles can be twisted to justify their opposite. Porter makes a shocking discovery. Paul Watson, the CSI tech on their task force, is actually the Four Monkey Killer, Anson Bishop himself. The killer staged his death, substituting another man's body in the bus accident while infiltrating the investigation. The deception unravels when Porter and Bishop visit the police station. Later, Porter learns Watson's credentials are fake and his fingerprints were found at a crime scene. Before Porter can act, Bishop stabs him in the thigh with a knife positioned near his common iliac artery, warning that removing it could be fatal. This twist transforms the narrative from a victim rescue mission into a cat-and-mouse game with a killer who's been manipulating the investigation from within. Bishop has been using Porter's team as unwitting pawns in his elaborate revenge scheme. Most chilling is how seamlessly Bishop blended in, raising an unsettling question. How well do we truly know those in our daily lives? Porter's team uncovers Arthur Talbot's elaborate Ponzi scheme, which uses new investor funds to pay earlier investors. More alarming, Talbot is selling development rights on land belonging to Emery Connors, property she inherited from her mother. The investigation leads to a condemned warehouse where they find Gunther Harbert, Talbot Enterprises' CFO, dead and handcuffed to a hospital gurney. In his hand is a brochure for the Moorings Lakeside, a Talbot development. Beneath the warehouse, they discover three white boxes containing human body parts, an ear, eyes, and a tongue, and tunnels leading directly to Talbot's property. Bishop has taken it upon himself to punish corporate corruption rather than letting the legal system handle it. His vigilante justice, though targeting genuine wrongdoing, becomes equally corrupt through its brutal methods. The line between justice and vengeance blurs dangerously. When systems fail to hold the powerful accountable, someone might take justice into their own hands. The disturbing question isn't why Bishop kills, it's why we might secretly root for him despite his horrific methods. Against medical advice, after being stabbed, Porter follows a hunch about a pocket watch found on the killer's body. The frozen hands at 314 lead him to 314 West Belmont, a property owned by Talbot's company. Inside the abandoned site, Porter discovers monkey sayings written in blood alongside body parts. He finds Bishop pushing a blindfolded, bleeding Arthur Talbot in a chair. Before Porter can intervene, Bishop pushes Talbot down an elevator shaft to his death. Porter hears Emery scream from another shaft, but Bishop escapes through underground tunnels despite officers guarding all exits. Days later, Emery recovers in the hospital, dehydrated with lacerated wrists, but alive. The investigation exposes 23 criminals in Talbot's organization, including high-ranking officers and judges. The novel ends with Porter finding a box containing a human ear belonging to his wife's killer and a note from Bishop requesting help finding his mother. Porter faces an impossible choice: compromise his integrity to work with a serial killer for personal vengeance. The cycle of trauma continues, with victims potentially becoming perpetrators. Can we break free from our past, or are we doomed to repeat established patterns?